This work is a collaboration between Predictive Science and our colleagues, Carl Henney and Nick Argie at AFRL in Kirtland, and because they work for the Air Force, they don't get to come to this meeting. So coronal models like the one that Cooper was just talking about typically rely on synoptic magnetic maps. That one actually didn't. But this is kind of the standard way you go about this. And so these maps are built up over the course of a solar rotation. And so they've often called, the synoptic word itself is not really very good because it's not everything all the time. It's diachronic is really a perhaps better term that people are now using. And there's two well-known problems. First, the sun's magnetic flux is always evolving. And so the data is as much as 27 days old. The second is that the line of sight field from the sun's poles is poorly observed, we know that. And so you end up filling in the polar fields from these maps with a variety of interpolation and extrapolation techniques. Now, photospheric flux evolution models can in principle help us to address both of these issues and to create what we'll call synchronic maps. That is, you want a map that represents the sun's field as well as you can at a given time. Now, last year, I focused on this issue of the poorly observed fields at the sun's poles. This year, I'm going to focus on the evolutionary aspect. So I want to give you a little bit of picture then of, so you know, where is it we're thinking we want to go on this? And I decided I should put this up here, is just that, you know, we actually do large-scale coronal modeling rather routinely now, and you can, for example, for the SDO era, you can download solutions from our website on that, and not just nice pictures of emission, you can actually get the data itself from those models, so you can avail yourself of that. But we know, of course, that even at solar minimum, the field is actually always evolving. And in fact, we think there may be very important aspects to that. For example, the origin of the slow solar wind may indeed be fundamentally dynamic. So if we observe the entire photospheric field all the time, continuously and simultaneously, we could then, in principle, drive our MHD models with this boundary data. But we don't. We don't, of course, observe that. And so flux evolution models have a long history of successfully modeling the photospheric response to known flows. So they can help us to, they can provide some of the, at least the evolutionary aspect of this and perhaps give us a better estimate of what the field is doing. And then we can use these models to assimilate data, such as magnetograms, on the Earth-facing side of the sun where the field is observed and fill in the gaps where it's not. Now, of course, there is, though, still one big problem, and that is that active regions emerge in unobserved portions of the sun. And so this can significantly change the coronal evolution. And so today I want to look at a little bit how important this effect is and how we can perhaps mitigate it some of the time. And unlike the, I believe the word Cooper used, fancy pants thermodynamic model, I'm actually just going to use PFSS models today. So the flux evolution model, of course, there are a number of these. Lockheed has this. Duncan Mackay and coworkers also do these as well. But the one we're using is called ADAPT for Air Force Data Assimilative Photospheric Flux Model, and it's based on this Worden and Harvey work, and it has all of the kind of the classic elements of flux evolution models. I should say that I am a user of this. I'm not a developer, and so this is a data source for me, really. But one thing we really like about their approach is that they've actually incorporated data assimilation techniques from atmospheric sciences into this. So it's not merely just pasting maps in, but they are using those techniques to change the field as they get new observations. And that's important for if you ever want to do a time-dependent MHD model, because that way the changes are smoother. And they're presently experimenting, though, with the incorporation of far-side images from helioseismology, and I'll be talking about that more today. So The particular situation we're going to look at was, this actually was the day of an eclipse in 2010. And I'm showing you now the positions for the Earth and the Stereo A and Stereo B spacecraft at this time, because we're going to be looking around this time period, actually, for the locations surrounding this. And so we can look at, well, coronal hole evolution, of course, is a very good marker for how corona itself is evolving. And so what I'm showing you here on the left and right are what would be synoptic images, again using this word, which were built up over the rotation from Stereo A and Stereo B. And you can see what, and so this is longitude, this is latitude, and you can see the dates that these encompass. And particularly what you can see, this long-lived, large-scale coronal hole feature definitely showed some evolution here over time. And so there's other coronal hole features that did as well. But this one in particular is the one I'm going to focus on. And in particular, that's because, before I get to that. And so this is now showing you then for the disk images that were, that as this region appeared, that when you saw it at Earth in late June, you can see this coronal hole rather well. You see it again shifted somewhat here, which turns out to just essentially be the geometry. Some 16 days later, it's changed radically. And notice this very bright emission over here. And that's because a coronal hole actually, an active region emerged during this time. And you can see that by looking at the MDI maps for this period. These are two of the standard MDI synoptic maps showing you sine latitude versus longitude. And the thing to note was that in this previous rotation, there's no active region over here, and then you can see later it was visible from Earth. And so the question is, well, when did this active region actually emerge? Oops. And so it turns out that this was detected with the gong helioseismology methods, and I'm again not an expert at this, and in fact it's Carl Henney who's using this data and incorporating it in an experimental way into ADAPT. And so from a signal like this, they guess at a distribution, really, of what that field would look like. The field strength can be estimated because this technique has now been around for over a decade, actually. And then they make an estimation of that, and the key thing is that you have to guess the polarity and the orientation. And so they use the Hale rules for that. For example, Hale's law for which is the leading or trailing polarity. But as we'll see, that guess is an important aspect of this. And so what I'm going to show you then, fairly simple set of calculations, is just we're going to compare, we have run the, or the ADAPT model was run and then provides us with flux-evolved maps that represent the state of the sun at a given time. And we're going to look first at one for June 23rd, then one for July 7th with what we'll call standard evolution, where we did not worry about this data from gong, then one with the gong region inserted, and then finally one where we reverse the leading and trailing polarity. So what I'm showing you here now, then, is using this map from ADAPT, you see the AIA image here, and you can see then that so what I've done is color the open and closed field regions that you get from tracing field lines in this PFSS model. And you can see that the coronal hole actually agrees quite well at this time period. And what's more is that if we then move to several days later when you could see it in Stereo A, you can see that, first of all, that the coronal hole hasn't changed very much, and indeed still this model on 623 agrees rather well with it. And you'll notice that this change then in where this coronal hole went had nothing to do, or had little to do with evolution. It's merely the fact that the tilt of the sun's rotation axis is different relative to Earth or stereo A. But now let's ask what happened when we get to July 14th. And now you can see that in this disk image that the coronal hole has changed quite a bit. This active region has emerged. And our model on June 23rd does not do a very good job. This region has changed a lot. And of course, our flux hasn't changed, so our model hasn't changed. Now let's ask, though, if we run the flux evolution model, but we don't include this far side imaging. And what you can see is that although we get some coronal hole evolution, it's a little bit more like this. We still have kind of more of a feature here. We've also now got kind of a larger coronal hole where there's really an active region. And so, again, we're not getting very good agreement. Now, when we ran the model, and this was using kind of, run in their standard way, but with the, but inserting this active region based on the far side data. And now you can see that the coronal hole agrees quite a bit better. You can see that this active region has now emerged over here. And that, and so now we seem to have done a lot better. It sounds like things are great. Okay, this is, but there is a cautionary tale in this, okay? And I think that is that let's ask what would have happened if we ran the flux evolution model, but we switched the polarity from the usual Hales rule, because the Hales rules don't always work, okay? They work a lot, but they don't always work. So we do the same model, but we get the polarity wrong. And now you see that the model is actually quite a bit worse. And so so there's a lot of promise in this technique in that clearly by including this data, it seems like we can do better. But because we don't know how to get the polarity from it, it may not, if we get that wrong, it may not be any better. In fact, it may be worse. So the larger picture of this is we're ultimately trying to go towards a time-dependent description of the corona. And we need time-dependent data to drive that. And so we're doing a lot of work right now, and these flux evolution models, we think, are a promising way to do that. And we're right now doing a lot of work just analyzing the fields that we get out of those and trying to understand a lot of the pitfalls. And so this is one example of what we're trying to look at. As I showed you, that active region emergence on the unobserved portions of the sun can significantly affect the coronal structure. And so we've demonstrated that in one case, though, incorporating this, these estimates from far-side acoustic imaging can improve the models. Ultimately, what we would really like is to have magnetographs that see more of the sun. And the next opportunity where that's really going to happen is solar orbiter. And this is probably dreaming given the budgets that we saw earlier, but I mean, an eventual L5 mission could really provide excellent data for dealing with these issues so that we can see more of the sun's magnetic field. Thank you.
I would think that stereo itself would give you better information on the backside, since you can produce images that look like what they see, that they see the regions as they erupt on the backside, and so you should be able to put in...
That's a wonderful project, David. Basically, what you're saying is somebody should be able to look at EUV images and produce what the magnetic field would be. Now, of course, if you actually look in different lines, you'll see that it's kind of tricky. But I think that's a fantastic project for you. In fact, if you can figure out the polarity from EUV imaging, that would be even better.
So the polarity won't be wrong in many cases, will it? I mean, it's how many active regions have the wrong polarity? Is it
I don't know.
5% or something? Or?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a good question, and I'm kind of curious. It might be a little different in this cycle. So, and of course, I mean, this far side acoustic imaging really only gets the largest ones. You're going to, you know, a lot of things you're going to miss.
Yeah. I also noticed that your predicted coronal holes were often a little bit broader than the observed ones. Is that something to do with using the potential model, or what?
Well, so actually, there was a whole Shine session on coronal holes where I gave a different talk. Okay, and in that talk, I discussed the difference between, because that we used the full thermodynamic model. Okay, and in that talk, I showed how the model, the mission, the dark regions can actually be different than the open field regions. They're close, but they can be broader or not.